say.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you in the process of getting John a P card?
He's got one.
Oh, he does? So now he can buy the plane tickets for you? No, Esther doesn't have to do that?
Yeah, way ahead of you, man. 10 moves ahead of you. 10 moves ahead of you.
Okay. I thought I heard her just talking about getting a plane ticket the other day.
Maybe back in the Stone Ages. No. All right, Scott, are we rolling? All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. It's approximately 1:33 in the commission room, June 5th, 2013. We have actually on the agenda today three different work sessions with three separate cases. And I, for the companies, you know, it really helps the commission scheduling when we can schedule these and announce them back-to-back. That way, if one finishes in 15 minutes, we don't have to wait 45 minutes to start the next one. I know the frustration for those maybe listening and here in the audience is that you don't know exactly when your stuff is going to come up. But so what the order today is we're going to do the Telluride Corporation ETC discussion first, and we'll get into the NSP discussion, and then we'll finish up with our own commission discussion on weights and measures program. So for this one, this is the the work session on case number PU 13-51. I don't have any opening comments. I would ask Commissioner Fedorchak if she has any, and then turn it over to Commissioner Crispin, who called this work session.
Nope, I have none.
Okay, thank you. And I don't have anything. Randy, it's your nickel.
Okay, thank you. As I think everybody, well, not in the room, but everybody that's involved with this case that's in the room knows, I've had a lot of concerns about the Lifeline-only program. And I want to make sure that North Dakota people have access to Lifeline services that legitimately qualify for Lifeline services. But at the same time, I don't want to see the kind of fraud and abuse that we've seen in some places around the country. And I don't know if I talked about it before. There was a Wall Street Journal article on February 11th that a study was done among the top five carriers of Lifeline. 41% of their customers at that time either could not demonstrate eligibility or just didn't respond.
What was the date of that?
That was in February.
Okay.
The 11th. And, you know, I think that there's been some FCC changes that have occurred, and hopefully the system is improving. But, you know, when we're talking about the top five carriers, why did it take any FCC or anybody else's rules to fix that problem? Why was there so much fraud and abuse before new rules came out? So it tells me that some rules are necessary. I think what has been set up by the FCC and Congress is a system that is ripe to entice things to go wrong. And so I think that we do need to make sure that as we enter into this, that we have some things in place to make sure that it's only legitimately eligible people that are getting these services. And I know we've already kind of entered into it in that there was one that was approved in December, I believe it was, last year anyway. But there's been change on the commission and more news about this issue since then. And I think both of them are reasons to revisit it and not just go by precedent and approve these real quickly. I looked through a lot of information on the program and FCC guidelines and what kind of considerations we can take into account and what we can't. And frankly, when they talk about that we need to deem it in the public interest, there's a lot of things that we can't take into consideration on what is the public interest. And frankly, I don't think that there's a lot of room outside of knowing that someone is incapable of providing the service or is just, you know, completely, obviously doing something wrong. I don't think we really have much room to deny these. However, I do believe that we can put on some qualifications onto their authorization to do business in North Dakota. And what I think, you know, part of the program through the FCC is They need to gather evidence of someone's eligibility. They cannot, I believe, save that evidence. They have to make sure that it's real and then either give it back or destroy it, but they can't save the evidence of eligibility. But what I think we could do is require them to send us a list of their customers with what program, what benefit that the customer was receiving that qualified them for the Lifeline program, and have them get a authorization of disclosure form signed by that customer so that we could take that list and run some samplings occasionally through the Department of Human Services, and they would thus be authorized to answer us whether those are in fact real people, and whether, and if they are real people, whether they are qualified to receive these benefits, and whether they are already receiving one or more Lifeline phones. And so that's kind of what I've put together here and wanted to throw out for discussion, if we want to put on some kind of a qualification like this. We would definitely need the disclosure release, because otherwise the Department of Human Services would be unable to respond to us and tell us whether or not someone is eligible. They could not even tell us whether someone on a, like, say, they couldn't even say two people on that list of 50 are ineligible. Because if they start doing that, then whenever they get to a list that's 100% eligible, they've just said all those people are eligible and disclosed information. So the only way that I can see for us to be able to at least check a sampling of these and verify eligibility is if we get a disclosure like this filled out with each customer. It's a one-page sheet. I'll hand a couple around here. Companies, Lifeline-only providers could have them partially filled out, and it would really just be a matter of the customer filling in their personal information and signing it. And so I don't think it would be a huge burden on the providers, and I do think it would provide us some assurance that it is, are in fact eligible people who are receiving the services.
Do you have anything else for now, I guess?
Ready? No.
I have a whole bunch of thoughts. Let Julie go first, maybe.
No, you go ahead.
Okay.
I'll follow up.
I guess the direct question, so you're not willing to vote for an order at this time without these additional provisions. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, not at this time. I would have to, I'd certainly want to hear some reasons why these provisions would be a problem, because I can see benefit to having them.
Well,
and unless there's really significant and serious problems with requiring them, then I would certainly want to have something on this order.
Sure. I guess, you know, right off the top, my thought is the why this program, why this company, the are we now going to open up the door that every company that receives universal service funds, that we go down to the level of detail you're asking here to make sure they're spending every penny of their universal service funds as required by law? Right now we get a certification from the company saying we've received universal service funds, we've spent them in the manner which they're supposed to be spent. End of story. And so I'm very reluctant to go any deeper in making the companies do any more than telling us, and that they certify they're doing it correctly. They filed their FCC plan. We're in the market of less regulation, not more regulation. If we have cases that there's come to our attention that there's fraud, we would investigate them like we always do. But I just, if we would open up this box here, I think you'd have to show why this program, and then we'd have to do, I think, provide the same filter in other areas, like I said, USF review, which that's not the intent of the FCC guidance or something I would approve, I guess, for me.
Well, I would argue that the two are connected in that, you know, I haven't seen any examples of the level of fraud and abuse is what I highlighted and what Congress is talking about at this very time that has been in this lifeline only segment of the industry. Mm-hmm. In the other universal service fund areas, we're just not seeing that kind of thing. But what we do see in other areas, both in our landline carriers and in our cell phone carriers around the state that have ETC status, is we see clear evidence of a lot of investment into infrastructure in the state that's helping people. But really all we have to go on these lifeline onlys are some pretty bad news stories.
I guess the follow-up to that would be, this is on Telright Corporations, and I see nothing in this record of anything that deals with Telright doing anything incorrectly. So the broader argument may be valid, but if we have to reopen the hearing to answer your questions, but I'll jump to the legal counsel there, but it seems to me that there's nothing in the record that would show Telright has done anything wrong, other than the questions we asked, and they answered those correctly. I shouldn't say they provided adequate information for me anyway.
And I don't really know what's in the record, but my thought was very similar, a basis for requiring it. And so you'd like maybe Pat is familiar with the record and could verify there is one or there isn't one. Otherwise, it might be a rulemaking that would apply to all companies.
Absolutely.
That this is, and I was just checking on the ETC rules. If we can print them quickly, I'll double check. But so it's equally applicable to all companies. Unless there is a basis for applying it to this company. If it's more of this would be a good thing to start doing, then you probably put it in the rules, and then it is equally applicable to all companies. So I can't answer your record question, though maybe Pat can.
To be clear, so Pat knows what question to answer, though, I'm talking not specifically about Telright, although I will say, in that Wall Street Journal article, they're one of the big five that were discussed. But
I would caution the commission from taking things in paper as part of a record, though.
Point taken.
It doesn't mean it's not accurate. It's just that we would need to have the company, someone provide an affidavit that this is true or not true. And I'm sure that'd be a great question to ask them when they were here and they did not show anything that.
But what wanting to discuss at this work session is the lifeline only carriers in general, mm-hmm. Not specifically Telright. That just is, I think, the first one on our list that is applied.
Okay. Commissioner, do you have any thoughts?
I do. First of all, thank you, Randy, for digging into this and spending some time. I have some questions for you because you've probably researched it more, and I know you've researched it more, and hopefully you can shed some light on it. I've read over a few things from the FCC and from our rules, but I'm still unclear of what exactly the FCC is doing themselves to address fraud and abuse, because I know they put this order out last year, 2012, suggesting that their reforms are going to save $2 billion. On this program and address some of these concerns. And they created this National Lifeline Accountability Database and some things like that. Are those taking, is it your estimation that those aren't enough and they aren't going to fix this problem, that we're closer to it and we'd be better equipped to help be kind of the stopgap on fraud here at the state level?
I'm skeptical that they will ever get anything finalized that will be
so
useful.
These aren't even implemented yet?
I don't
really?
I believe so.
Well, this is an order, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Order proposing rules.
You're talking about the...
We comprehensively reform and begin to modernize the Universal Service Funds Lifeline Program.
Yes.
2012.
Yes.
So these aren't adopted? What has to happen for these to become, like, in effect?
Well, that's what they say they're doing, and they have taken the steps to, they have several things that these lifeline-only ETCs must do. Mm-hmm. They must have a compliance plan that's approved by the commission. That's all final
the FCC.
Rules. The FCC does, yep. That's all, those are all final rules. And they say they're going to develop this national database, which would take time because it wouldn't be implemented immediately. But that order, in that order, they've taken the steps that they say they've taken steps they believe are necessary. They believe that it will address or reduce the fraud. They're hoping that it will.
Mm-hmm.
They believe those are the steps that need to be taken. So in answer to your question, they have adopted an order. Just like our orders, they mm-hmm. have said they're going to take these steps, and they...
Do you know if this database exists yet and what it would do? Sarah, you want to...
Yeah, Sarah's been doing a bunch of research.
Here.
Scott Sheldon has entered the room as well.
I've been doing some research for with Pat and Commissioner Crisman, and they've hired a contractor who is working to put the database together, and the expectation is that that database will be available by the end of this year. So it's not done yet. A couple of other things that they have been doing are auditing.
Before you leave the database, tell me what that will do. What's the purpose of the database?
The database will have all Lifeline carriers will have to put information in there unless you're one of the states that's already opted out of the database. So there's some states that have their own Lifeline registration process that have opted out, like California, Oregon, I think Vermont, Puerto Rico, which isn't really a state, but they've opted out too. So
someone has left the conference.
There's about 9 of them, I believe, that have opted out. But what that will have in for all those telephone providers, Lifeline providers that are in the databases, it'll have the name of all the parties that or clients that have an account with them, and what their addresses are, and what kind of, did they show a SNAP card or a Medicaid card? How did they determine their qualification? And I believe they might even have the last 4 of their social in there. I'm not sure. But then if you are a provider, then you can go, once that database is up and operating, you will put names of your clients in there, and then you can also check to see if there's duplication in that database.
So when that's up and running, wouldn't we be duplicating that with what Randy's proposed?
Well, there's no checking. There's no auditing through this database. Mainly what this database can do is prove that you're not duplicating service, which is one of the ways that the fraud is occurring, that especially with the Lifeline-only carriers, is that people are getting duplicate phones at the same service, whereas if you used the landline program before, you couldn't duplicate service at the same address. And so that's what they can do, but they're not going to check whether you really have a SNAP card or not through that. Now, there are states that do check stuff like that now, and they're saying there was something I read where if you're doing that kind of a checking, you have less problems in terms of people getting into the program that aren't qualified. And there were some specific states cited that did check versus states that didn't, and the growth, the differences in the states that checked versus those that didn't in terms of the Lifeline-only wireless mm-hmm. participation rates.
Okay. Then, Randy, do you have concerns about the cost of this? I mean, who on staff is going to check all these things that are filed with us and keep up with this? And how many, what would we be talking about in terms of numbers?
I don't know the answers who would do it. The numbers would depend on how many we chose to do. the Department of Human Services, the person I talked to over there, said, you know, we couldn't just do like thousands of these a month,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that they could do, you know, some sampling. So, you know, I wouldn't imagine we would do large volumes of them, but some sort of a sampling that might come through. One of my concerns in the previous dialogue when Sarah explained the list that the FCC is working on and hopes to have done by the end of this year, but I'm a skeptical of these types of plans. But if we, so then we get a customer's name from one of the carriers, and what do we do with that? We can't take a sampling or even one that we're suspicious of and call Human Services because we don't have this release. They will not answer that question for us.
Say that again. Mm-hmm. If we get a complaint on services, we certainly have the ability to follow up on a complaint, if that's what you're saying.
No.
But Human Services, if someone
I see your point. Okay.
Received a Lifeline phone because they were SNAP eligible, so we get that, but we can call over. They can't tell us whether they are or not
I see your
SNAP
point.
Eligible.
Yep.
That would be the whole point of
signing the release as part of
having the companies get releases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then in terms of the company's plan, I read through their application again, and I couldn't find a specific plan in their application for addressing abuse. Are they supposed to have that in their application to us, or is that part of their compliance with the FCC?
I don't think the companies were asked to address how they're going to to reduce abuse. I think the companies are supposed to file the FCC's requirements, and in the compliance plan, they tell the FCC, you know, how they're going to meet the customer qualification, how they're going to check.
On
the eligibility and check that they're not duplicating customers and one per household. And they verify in their applications mm-hmm. that they agree to do that.
And they also answered that question in the informal.
But I don't think any of them that we've read have come up with plans other than what the FCC is requiring.
Yeah. If I could just follow up with Pat there. Over the past, I would say, 3 months, we've received a lot more calls about Lifeline LinkUp, and I think the biggest thing that I've noticed is the fact that people are now having to reapply. It used to be a renewal where you just get one saying that you are still eligible for this program, you are still going to receive it. Well, people got used to getting that. All of a sudden now, instead of that one page, they have five-page application where they now have to verify all this. This was to stop some of the fraud.
Mm.
And so these new applications, and it didn't matter. It started on this day, and everybody had to fill out a new application. If you just got it 6 months ago, you didn't get a renewal, you had to fill out the application all again. That was, from what I understand from some of our NARUC meetings, that was the way they were going to start this fraud cleanup, was to go everybody reapply today. And so we had quite a few of our North Dakota consumers that had just renewed, and all of a sudden they go, well, I've sent it in. Well, you know, CenturyLink would say they didn't fill it out. So then it was a process of getting them to fill out the complete application that maybe they filled out 5 years ago. That was my input.
I'm not sure it's necessarily has to be a full application, but he does bring up a point that there is a recertification process every year. And in fact, through this recertification this year, they said that they've already met their savings target because a lot of people didn't recertify.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they're not qualified. It's just maybe because of some of the things Scott said, that they were frustrated by the process or whatever, so they didn't recertify.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first year of the recertification, too. So the way the companies might be having them do it could be a longer process than what they will be doing, you know, long term with it. Because the FCC actually says you have three ways you can do it, that you could even do it with a phone online or paper form. So it's just a recertification. It shouldn't have to be a full reapplication.
Do the companies have to certify to the commission, similar to the USF certification, that they have canvassed their people and their people are using the ETC only as intended? They don't do anything like that, do they?
There are. The FCC does have a filing requirement that would be copied to the state.
Okay, so they certify to the FCC that they are using these, that they are cleaning up their own list, if you will.
Right, it's not about the funds, it's about the customers that they have certified the customers are eligible. And
see, I guess that part for me, Randy, is that the fact that that's taking place means we're similar, doing the same way we're doing the USF review. Companies certify that they're using the USF dollars appropriately. We get that from them, and we forward it along. We're getting they are certifying to someone they're doing the things correctly. If we ever got a case, a hard, fast case, where somebody pointed out abuse in USF dollars or abuse in ETC dollars, we'd have a statement from the company saying that wasn't happening. The first thing we would do is suspend all their license to do things, and then we'd open up an investigation on it. That's the way, in my mind, that we could do this, and that'd be very similar to how we do other areas. So. Okay. Anything else, Commissioner?
What have you learned anything in your research on what other states are doing? Anything jump out in terms of how others? Because obviously, other states have set up their own programs for this reason, to address the fraud and abuse. Or is that not the driving factor on what other states, how other states are trying to manage this program?
Well, two states in particular, they pointed out, are best practice states, and it was the states of Nebraska and Florida. And in both those states, when you go, say, for example, to get your SNAP card, they will give you input right then and there on who the carriers are and how you can go about signing up for Lifeline.
And I thought we used to have that here. Scott talked about them, Medicaid eligible folks getting a form for ETC or Lifeline at one point, and I don't know if that's stopped or not, but I thought that they were involved in this certification process at one point.
Yeah, you're correct, but it didn't cover all the companies in the state. It just covered, a couple. It covered the bigger, U.S. West, now Quest, CenturyLink, and it included SRT.
Someone has entered
couldn't
the conference.
We, if we were the manager of who gets this designation, couldn't we be updating Human Services with a new list every time we add a company and say, here's the list, please share this with your folks so that they're getting that on the front end? Or have they stopped, because they don't have the complete list, did they stop using or stop doing that for the program?
Well, they haven't stopped doing it for the companies that they've been doing it for in the past. But they aren't prepared to take on all the companies, I believe, from what Commissioner Crisman had found out.
You mean they have the actual application forms from each company? It's different, and they gave them those?
They have, they have the customer, the people who are going to be eligible are their customers.
Right.
As well. And so they know who the customers are, but they aren't in the business of doing the recertification for all the companies. To say, yes, these customers, telling the companies, giving each company a list of customers who are still eligible.
I think, I think we're on, looking at two different paths here. My understanding of the best practices term or label for Nebraska and Florida's program is because it encourages more people who are qualified to get signed up for Lifeline service. So that's one thing, and I think we all want that. If someone's legitimately qualified, we'd like them to get service. The other part that I'm trying to address is people providing service, either in duplicates to people who are eligible or to people who are ineligible. And, what Florida and Nebraska are doing, I don't think addresses that at all.
unless they're doing something else. But having human services promote the program doesn't do anything to eliminate abuse of the program.
Yeah, I might have misstated a little bit, or maybe you misunderstood, but the human services, any of their customers that are eligible, they get a certificate.
They get told about it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that part of it is working very similar, I think, to mm-hmm. Florida and Nebraska. And then, but I think the other part is true as well, that it doesn't help the other situation.
Right.
So, Randy, your plan was just to have them fill out this form. There was one other piece of it, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, there needs to be something that indicates what program that client is eligible for that causes them to qualify for Lifeline. Maybe it's SNAP, maybe it's heat assistance, mm-hmm. maybe it's something else. And, you know, that would have to be a known. And that's not included on this particular form.
That they'd file that with us when we asked?
They'd file it presumably with the company who would file Keep it with that. Us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a list that, you know, that person A is eligible because of their eligibility for whichever program, and then this release.
And that isn't part of the application now, that they have to say why they're eligible? That just somebody has met, I mean, they just check a box, like we're eligible, and we proved it to somebody?
No, the companies go up.
No, usually what will happen is, say I'm eligible, I might go to Telluride or some other company at one of their events, and I would show them my SNAP card or
right.
whatever, and then they would write down or put into their computer program that that's how I determined that I was eligible for mm-hmm. the program. And I think what...
Well, that's captured already, what Randy's saying.
To the extent that people don't with this information. For example, my husband used to do background checks, and, you know, he could tell a fake Social Security card. So there can be people that get a hold of cards and do things that aren't legal, per se, and those types of people could be kicked out of the program because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe they have to gather that information anyway.
Yeah,
the issue would be with them turning it to us.
Mm-hmm. And you're thinking they should do that for every customer, file that with us? Or just a certain number that we sample at some point?
No, I think they should just
file that with us.
File it in.
So basically they'd be filing all their customer applications, kind of. I mean,
I don't know if there's more to the I'm sure there's more to the application that they need that we don't need, you know.
Yeah.
So they can keep track of their customers mm-hmm. and what their phone numbers are and things. There's mm-hmm. probably lots of information. I really don't know what all they acquire in order to sign someone up.
And then
these
would
be the things that we would need if we are going to assure that the program is done right.
Mm-hmm. And then we would have to have somebody looking at all those forms to make sure that it's there. And then we would check a few of them to see if they were valid.
That's my thought.
Yeah. Well, my biggest concern would be staff time. And also for a program that is kind of hoisted on us, and I appreciate your interest in reducing fraud and waste in this program, despite the fact that it's a federal program, we aren't ultimately responsible for it. So, I just don't know if it's worth the staff time to do it, when I think it might be a little bit duplicative with some of the things that are going on the broader level.
Staff time is my biggest concern, too, in that, but
I don't see
it's a legitimate concern.
Getting these, though, you know, that wouldn't be a huge issue, and you could still do the, without having all those applications filed with us. Couldn't we, you know, randomly do some checks with the applications on file with the companies? Rather than taking in all that paperwork and committing to looking at it, which that could be aggressive.
It's an idea, I guess, as I would continue to evaluate. My question would be, so would we just ask them to send us a few that look the cleanest? Or if we don't have them, how do we select which are the random few that we chose to evaluate?
I'm not sure how we would be able to tell from an application what. I'm not a private investigator, however, nor do we have any on staff. So if with a piece of paper, I don't know how you'd tell.
Maybe if the company sent us just the computer list of their customers, that we could even pick out a certain percentage of them, and then that they would have this information. I don't know.
Yep.
That's because you're right, staff time is a concern in this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anything else, Commissioner?
I think I've given you everything I know
anything
about.
Else? Okay, so I guess my plan would be the I'll put together an order for the next meeting, and you'll get a chance to look at it and see what you want to do with it, I guess. Because my intention is to put forward an order saying we'll approve it. I appreciate the concerns of that you brought out, but the backdrop of recertification every year, the backdrop of the national database being put together, the why we would target these companies who have not shown us in North Dakota do anything incorrect. I mean, we have to trust companies doing business in front of us unless shown otherwise. It's not just telephones. It's weights and measures. It's pipeline safety. It's all those things, and we put protocol into place. And if they don't do something, we have an investigation and we go through on it. But my biggest concern is not staff time. It's taking the assumption right off the bat that the companies aren't going to do what they're supposed to do. That's my biggest concern. I think that if we see a trend in if there wasn't things that were taking place right now, I would say I might be inclined to do a little more things, but I think it's going the right way. And we're deregulating telephones. USF dollars are getting cut because the part of me thinks that the underlying concern here is the draining of the USF fund, which is a separate issue, not the company's certification. So that's the way I kind of see it. So we'll have to see how this plays out. So any thoughts to that?
Well, you have apparently more faith in the FCC to get this done and make it work than
I do. I have faith
in
the companies.
I don't think the last year or two that all the companies have earned that faith. I'm sure some of them have.
And if we see
others haven't.
If we see a case of fraud or abuse, we'll investigate it and we'll do what we're supposed to do. And you know, we could approve this order potentially and have the next day there could be a case filed of abuse and we would act on it.
I guess, you know, to say that we would do something if we see something, we will only see something if we look. Mm-hmm. And the way the system is set up, if we don't impose some requirements, we have no way of looking.
So why don't we go back to my previous point? So why don't we go out and investigate server telephone and make sure they're spending every penny of USF dollars correctly? That's a much bigger target of abuse.
Well, if
I think you look at people that we have all known and met that live in this SRT area or any other area of the state, and you see the infrastructure and everything that's in place, you know, it doesn't cause a lot of suspicion. You see that a lot of money has been invested the way it was supposed to, so it doesn't cause suspicion. When you read some of these publications about what's been going on around the country, the way the cost of this program has escalated in the last couple of years since the non-facility-based lifeline-only providers have been in business, it does cause some room for suspicion.
If we want to, and I'll have to look to legal counsel here again, I don't think that not approving this, there's not anything in the record that would say why we have any grounds to not approve it. If we want to open back up the hearing and get them back in there, and if you want to ask them those questions and let them respond, I would be okay with that perhaps. But I just, we can't just take hearsay and apply it to a case that has been in front of us. And so that's another of the concerns that I would have. So I don't know, legally, you want to chime in on that at all, but that's the way I see some of this is why it may be valid. It's hearsay unless it is asked questions inside the hearing.
Yeah, and we started with this question of asking somebody who knew something about the record whether there was anything in there. But you definitely need something in the existing record to relate to an imposition of a condition. You know, you need to connect those dots in this particular case. A separate discussion, which could be more generic, is whether you want to have additional requirements apply to, say, all Lifeline only, you know, your resale, I guess, eligible carriers, okay? And then what was going through my mind at the end of this conversation is checking our authority for even doing that, a condition on your eligible carrier status as opposed to general designation. I'm not saying we don't. There's a good reason we don't have a lot of authority to go investigate use of universal service funds, and that's because we don't have rate of return regulation.
Right.
So, I mean, seriously, there is a body of telecom law here that would need to be investigated more thoroughly about authority. But definitely in this situation, in this case, you would need something in the record to impose a condition on this company, some basis different from
what is our
conditions on others.
So could we take Commissioner Crispin's and Fedorchuk's, for that matter, questions and say you compile a list of questions that you basically have that of the concerns you have, give back to the company and let them answer. We supplement the record. If you're still not happy, then at least we've got a record to do one thing or the other. Right now we just have a filing and an informal discussion. We asked a few questions. And so maybe we should have had a formal hearing on this, but that's all. Things get started before you get different people in the mix. I'm not against waiting to do and doing those things at all. If
my concerns are more broadly, I should say, so I see it two separate issues. We've got the Telrite application, and we've got how we're handling Lifeline in general.
Absolutely.
Telrite happened to be the first one that Randy and I dealt with, so this became the case for learning about this and asking questions about the program in general and what our role is in oversight. I mean, the FCC has boxed us in. They've, like, what's our point? Really? What are we doing?
They've taken away state.
We don't, we just like, nope, yep, okay, and then sign it and off you go.
Just like it's, the border, the exchange boundaries. We have no role in it except that there was disagreements.
Yeah, so anyway, I don't know how Randy feels about the Telrite application itself. I'm comfortable moving ahead with that, but I'm not saying that we shouldn't look into what we can do to help on a state level address the fraud and abuse. This is different than the other programs. I mean, they're in terms of just trusting the companies, there's been documented significant abuse and fraud in this program. Children filling out applications with no addresses, you know, applications with hospital addresses. I mean, it's been ripe with fraud and abuse. And so I think asking the questions is legitimate. If we can find a role for us, great. Sounds to me like the FCC has got our hands tied behind our back, and we may not have much we can do, but I don't think there's been anything lost in asking the questions.
And I think putting qualifications on is the most we can do. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we approve this and probably just about every other one that would apply. But what we do have new since the one that was approved in 2012 is two things. Two new commissioners, a lot more public knowledge, and you're right, it's not in a hearing, but it certainly is out there. Those are the two new things. What if we choose to just move along with Telrite's as we continue to gather information, then I think we have chosen to ignore whatever value there is in the public knowledge and the fact that there's a new commission in place, and we've set a precedent then, and then I think we would have kind of some obligation to treat the other applicants that are in their process right now the same as we would treat Telrite here.
Sure. I go back to the both you and Julie brought up the fact that there's the point that there's a lot of information out there of abuse in the program. I think we have the company answer that question. as a late file, as some type of exhibit. And we put that on them beforehand because since we've discussed it so much, the fact that it isn't in the record, we should put it in the record to see what their response is, and then we should look at it again. If they come back with a response that says, you know, we're aware of all this, we really haven't done anything to make it better, that gives us some grounds to then put the extra condition on them. And if they come back and say, we've done A, B, C, D, E, and we feel the trend line's going the other way, that's maybe a different picture.
They could also agree to do what you want. I mean, they can agree to do things that maybe you don't have authority to force them to do, right. But they can agree to do things.
So they listen to this discussion. If we send them a letter and they come back and say, well, we agree to everything that the commissioners are talking about, we just want this designation, it's easy.
Yeah. And that would be the easiest, and hopefully that happens. My other question, though, kind of procedurally, so if I work with staff and we put together some questions, would we send those to Telluride, because that happens to be the first one on our list right now, or would we send those to all the providers, potential providers that have an application in the process right now? Because really, to me, I don't mean any of this to be focused on Telluride specifically. I mean it to be focused on the Lifeline only wireless providers in general. And so I'm thinking we should do the same list of questions to all of them.
And my response to that is that we've had this question for many years, and we have the same response. In theory, you can set requirements and parameters on companies order by order, which would mean this one first and then the next one that comes up and the next one comes up. But it's not really the best way to approach it, because a company needs to be able to know exactly what their requirements are. So the concern that I'm hearing is widespread and very in a sort of general and national, and it seems to me that that's appropriate for rulemaking. And then what you do, you get this word out to these people, but you get it out via rulemaking that these are the kinds of things we are contemplating imposing on all applicants. Okay?
We move the bar on wind farms progressively, every wind farm, because of that, and it ended up being a rule package.
Yeah, industry needs to know what the ground rules are, and this seems to be one of the items on the list that would make sense to be in there. Again, looking through authority and what is existing authority for eligible carrier designation and the existing rules for eligible carrier that they have to file every year. So that's what I would recommend going forward, because it's something you're contemplating applying to every eligible carrier applicant or everyone that falls into a certain category. Yeah.
Could it be a certification document, kind of like the extra form that a lot of the companies sign when we cite them? Could it be something like that?
It could be. And again, you could take a very similar, you could use the analogy if you reopen the proceeding. We used to ask those questions. Do you promise this? Do you promise that? Do you promise the next thing? We quit asking the questions for an hour at the hearing and turned it into a certification form in citing. It is something, though, that was always asked of everyone. It was just asked in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And you could ask them if they're willing to commit to these things that way for this case. But for the future, I think you would want to – I just think you would want to impose a rule.
Yeah.
So I understand your point, but I don't understand the specifics. Are you suggesting that we do as our chairman suggested and send out some questions to these companies? Or are you suggesting we start a rulemaking procedure so that they come in and comment on the rule?
Unless there's something in the record today for this company, you would reopen that record, the proceeding. You didn't have a real hearing. I think you had an informal. Could have a real hearing or another informal. You would reopen it and ask those questions of that company, the current company, and then you would have a rulemaking proceeding for everybody else.
Right. But would we have to reopen the hearing? Couldn't we just have you send a letter to them with specific questions, and they could respond, and we could ask it to be added to the record?
Yes. You're reopening the record, okay. Either.
I'm just
verbally or in
writing. To change the visual picture from a hearing, them coming in, to a letter from commission advisors with these questions. And then we look at their responses back, make a decision on Telluride, and then whatever decision Telluride becomes, that may become the basis for the rules package going forward.
They may ask for an opportunity to be heard. They would have a right to ask for a hearing or an informal, because they have a right to be heard orally as opposed to just doing something in writing. But we don't have to force that. We can.
Because the other scenario is if we have a case in front of us that if we have to do something with it. So let's say we vote to not approve it. They appeal it, and you look at the grounds of what we didn't why we didn't approve it. It would not stand very, very well in my mind right now. But that's the backdrop I think of it. So okay, I'm fine with that. If the question becomes, are you okay with that, getting additional information? I assume you are.
I think it's a very good idea.
So now Patrick doesn't like it.
No, I guess what my impression of what you're talking about is writing to the company and asking if they would agree to certain conditions on the designation of ETC for lifeline only. So you would write to them and say, would you agree that you provide this every year? Would you agree that you provide this and this and this? And then they would say whether they would agree to that or not.
As well as ask the question of them how has Telluride dealt with abuse cases in other jurisdictions?
Sure.
What's their quality control program to assure that there's not abuse in the program, which I think is the basis of your argument, which is solid.
Right. And then for each company that comes in, just like with siting, for each company that comes in, we ask the questions or have them sign that document. But for each company that comes in, at the informal, we ask them the same things until you have a rulemaking completed that includes those things.
That's be fine with me, those two provisions. And if there's something else that I'm sure you put something together, you'll do one staff around with us before you send it out.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Sure.
Just one caveat from legal. The citing requirements are very specific in law and rule today. And so all those 300 questions probably can trace back to something that exists in law or rule and did since 1977 or whenever they were written. I'm not so sure here on telephone. And so we have to investigate the commission's authority to even do Plan A.
Well, but if they would agree to it.
If they would agree to it, yes. I meant Plan A.
That becomes the basis. If they come back and say, forget it, we ain't doing nothing.
Right.
And then we look at it, and then we have to make a decision. If we don't approve it, does it uphold?
Right.
Is it withheld up on appeal?
Yeah. But we will look into the generic authority and for the future cases and the rules package.
Okay. Going once, going twice?
Gone.
Julie?
Nope.
All right. With that, we'll close the work session on case number PU 13-51. All right. Thank you. And we'll...